weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We're going to start the program today with a story we've been covering closely for the last few weeks, the kidnapping of more than 200 girls at a boarding school in Nigeria last month. There have been a number of new developments we want to tell you about, including mounting pressure on the government of Nigeria to step up its efforts to find the girls, that pressure coming from the streets of Nigeria online and in cities around the world. We wanted to hear more about this, so in a few minutes we'll be joined by NPR Africa correspondent Ophelia Quist-Arkton. She will be joining us from Dakar, Senegal. But first, we go to Chika Odua. She is a freelance journalist with us from Abuja in Nigeria. Chika, welcome back. Thanks for joining us once again.
It's a pleasure.
It seemed at first that there was some ambiguity about who was responsible for this kidnapping, although all signs seem to point to the terrorist group Boko Haram. Now that group has claimed responsibility. Am I right? What exactly have they said?
Boko Haram claimed responsibility for the abduction. The leader, Abubakar Shekau, has released a video in which he directly says, "We abducted your girls." And of course, that is a direct reference to the April 14th attack at the school in Chibok. However, there is kind of a discrepancy on who is still in charge or who is behind. The first lady, Patience Jonathan, held a meeting with some of the women who are from Chibok. This meeting was held yesterday throughout most of the day. And one of the mothers says that the first lady is actually blaming residents of Chibok. She's also saying that perhaps the Borno state governor may have a hand, or maybe he knows where the girls are being taken. So at this point, the responsibility is taking a political dynamic. So everyone is kind of pointing fingers on who could be responsible. But yes, Boko Haram has now come out to claim responsibility.
Tell me a little bit more about what they said. Did they offer a reason in this video?
There's no reason. All he said was that we've taken your girls. And this is, again, just going back to previous messages, confirming previous messages where he says that we're going to increase attacks on schools, on religious facilities, and again, just throughout Abuja. Also, after the Nanya attack, Abubakar Shekau came out and said, "You don't know where we are, but we are in your cities." So he seems to be restating what he's been saying before. No reason was given. We do understand that some of the girls were from various tribes, both Christian and Muslim. Again, no reason was given, but he has come out to claim responsibility.
I know that you've spoken with some of the families of the girls involved. Can you tell us a little bit more about what they have said?
She's saying that they have lost confidence completely in the Nigerian government. Just shortly after the abduction took place on April 14th, the defense ministry came out to say that most of the girls had been rescued. They said, "No, sorry, we made a mistake." So now people are even losing confidence in the government's capability to even rescue these girls.
You were saying that the wife of the president has suggested that the local authorities are somehow complicit in this. I'm going to hear more about this from Ophelia in just a few minutes. But does anyone credit that? Of the people that you have been speaking with, the citizens who are following this, does anybody credit that? Does anybody think that that might be true?
Of course not. Many people are saying that this obviously has a political coloration. And the Borno governor, it's important to note that he's coming from a different party from the president. So perhaps there's a political motive there. She outrightly said, according to one of the mothers who met with her yesterday, that these locals may be involved or they know where the girls have been taken. So this was suggested by the first lady herself.
And as we mentioned, we're going to hear more about the international response to this in a minute. But Chika, could I just ask you, how big of a story is this where you are?
This is a huge story. Actually, women in Abuja gathered themselves last week to conduct a protest, a rally in the rain. And they were able to gather support, mostly from young people, young Nigerians. So they've been holding meetings every single day in Abuja, not just in Abuja. Lagos has joined, Kano has joined. So these Bring Back Our Girls campaign meetings are held every day in Abuja from 3 in the afternoon to 7 p.m. And this is where they strategize on what to do next. And of course, social media is where most Nigerians have gone to fuel their angst. So it is a very huge story.
Chika Odua is a freelance journalist with us from Abuja in Nigeria. Chika, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to Ophibia Quist-Arkt, an NPR Africa correspondent with us from Dakar. Ophibia, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, greetings. More on this sorrowful story, and it gets more and more complicated.
Please tell us more about that, Ophibia. I wanted to amplify something that Chika mentioned, which is now that the wife of President Goodluck Jonathan was suggesting that the local authorities in this region might somehow be involved. Could you tell us a little bit more about what's going on?
Apparently, Patience Jonathan, and she's a powerful and influential woman within her own right, although, of course, she has no political power as such and no formal role, had asked the Chibok mothers, the mothers of these missing girls, to come and see her. And apparently she feels slighted that instead of the mothers, who, of course, are distraught, anxious, protesting, didn't come themselves but sent a representative to see her, somebody called Naomi Mutar Nyadar, who was one of the organizers of the protest march in Abuja, the capital, on Wednesday. Now, Saratu Angus Indirpaya, who's from Chibok, says that she went along with this activist to see the first lady, who accused them. First of all, she expressed doubts about the mass kidnapping and accused the Chibok people and the families of belonging to Boko Haram, the insurgent network, which has claimed responsibility for the girls' abductions. And Indirpaya says the First Lady even accused them of fabricating the story to give her husband, President Goodluck Jonathan, and his government a bad name.
Hmm.
This is just making the whole thing even more complicated. And as we've heard, Abubakar Shekau, who is the putative leader of Boko Haram, has now come out with this video, as Chika has said, and he's using this, almost echoing the Twitter hashtag, bring back our girls, by saying, I've got your girls. He's also said, I abducted your girls, by Allah, I will sell them in the marketplace. And of course, that evokes such fear because we're already hearing reports that these young women aged between 16 and 18 from the government girls' secondary school in Chibok have been sold into marriage. Marriages, in inverted commas, in quotes, to their captors, that they're being used as sex slaves and as servants. So this is going to make it even more distressing for the families, although we're told 50-odd did manage to escape. But the numbers have gone up from 200 to 270. Almost 300 girls, it seems, were abducted mid-April, exactly 3 weeks ago tonight.
This is not the first time that Boko Haram has attacked a school. Is it seen as an escalation? How do you view this?
This mass abduction of these schoolgirls is unprecedented. The fact that in the past some boys have been killed, have had their throats slit. The girls have been told, and don't forget that Boko Haram means Boko in Hausa, the main local language in the north. Book, Haram, sin or forbidden. So Western education, loosely, is forbidden. The girls have been told, go home, get married, and give up your studies in the past. But this time, the girls have actually been trucked by militant extremists who were posing as soldiers in uniforms, and a big question mark about what has happened to them. This is why President Goodluck Jonathan is under such pressure. 3 weeks. How come the families, the activists, the campaigners who are marching from Abuja to New York, how come they're saying that the intelligence that the military should have, they don't even know where these girls are? Nigerians want answers, and they want answers now. These girls are part of Nigeria's elite.
In South Korea, the prime minister resigned over that terrible ferry disaster there where more than 200 people died, including many school children. Has there been any accountability within the Nigerian government for the failure to address this so far?
Nobody has offered to step down, if that's what you're asking, Michelle. I mean, look how long it has taken President Goodluck Jonathan to speak out publicly. Certainly, we're not expecting any. Perhaps people might be fired, but we're not expecting people to resign voluntarily. I think this is why there is such criticism of the president. He was seen dancing in Kano, also in the north, hours after the girl's abduction at one of his party gatherings. And don't forget that the elections are coming up in Nigeria next year. And the elections always herald, I'm afraid, trouble. And often violence and certainly politicking. But Nigerians are saying, hey, keep the politics out of this. These are the lives of young women. They could be your daughters, your sisters, your nieces. They are our future. But you have President Goodluck Jonathan's party pointing to the three states, including Borno, where Chibok is, where the girls' school is, under those three states under emergency rule for the past year. They are run by the opposition. So you have both sides pointing fingers, but Nigerians are saying, forget that. Politicians, find these girls. We have a military, we have a police force that goes abroad to Liberia, to Sierra Leone, on peacekeeping missions. How about in our own country? They have got to find these girls. And don't forget also, Michelle, that we're just a couple of days away from Abuja, the capital, hosting the World Economic Forum for Africa. The Chinese premier is the honoured guest. Nigeria has promised that it can ensure security. And yet we saw a second bomb, car bomb attack outside Abuja within miles of the seat of government on Thursday. So everybody is very nervous and very jittery and very, very angry.
Afibia Christ-Arkton is NPR's Africa correspondent with us from Dakar, Senegal. Afibia, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Michelle, we'll keep you updated.
We also heard from Chika Odua. She's a freelance journalist who had joined us previously from Abuja, Nigeria. We hope you'll stay with us. Just ahead, we're going to take a look at the global activism online and in cities around the world aimed at finding these missing Nigerian schoolgirls. The hashtag #BringBackOurGirls is making its mark. We're going to speak to the former head of TransAfrica, Nicole Lee, about this and also about her career in advocacy. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
On the next Fresh Air, comic Todd Barry. His new online video, The Crowd Work Tour, follows him as he goes on stage without notes, interacting with the audience.
I don't get political. I don't get personal. Some people say I don't get funny, but not you.
He's appearing in the new season of Louis C.K.'s Louis. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Continuing with our top story today, we want to look at what activists have been doing around the world in response to the kidnapping of those 200-plus schoolgirls in Nigeria. On Twitter, activists have started a hashtag campaign, Bring Back Our Girls, to keep focus on the crisis and to keep up pressure on the government. We wanted to learn more, so we've called upon Nicole Lee, a human rights activist and until recently president of TransAfrica. That's a nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C., that was founded by African Americans to advance the interests of Africa and the Caribbean in U.S. policy. And she's with us now in our studios. Welcome back to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I wanted to start off by asking you about the Twitter campaign at the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls. I was wondering what we know about how this started. And I was also wondering if it is in part kind of an indictment of the media coverage in the mainstream media about this.
Well, it's amazing because certainly we know there are all these Twitter spheres, if you will. And so there is an African Twitter. And so this started on African Twitter. I know I saw it about a week ago, Bring Back Our Girls. And it was very clear that it was coming from Nigeria. It was Nigerian Twitter followers that were really retweeting and retweeting. And it became a trend. There were others that were also trying to capture it. But I think the message of Bring Back Our Girls really caught on because it makes anyone who's tweeting it, you have to take ownership of these young women. Even though they're Nigeria, you may not have ever been to Nigeria yet, we all have to take ownership of the girls. And I think that that's one of the reasons why it's so very powerful. It's indigenous to Nigeria, and it's something that we all can support.
Well, speaking of the sense of ownership of it, what is your role as an activist, as an American activist at a time like this?
You know, I think about 30 years ago when we were working on the anti-apartheid movement as Americans and as trans Africa, and what was our role back then? And I really think it is to stand in solidarity with the people of Nigeria, with the families, that not necessarily we don't always need to be in the lead, but we can always follow and we can always support. One of the things that's really changed in the last 30 years is the diaspora organizations, but just the diaspora members. So we have so many Nigerian Americans here now, or first or second generation Nigerians, that are really taking the lead in New York and in Washington. I was at the demonstration in Washington, and it was amazing how many young Nigerians were out. And it was also amazing how many Americans who are not from Nigeria, white, black, Latina, also came out and really supported. So I think at a time like this, we really need to first get our lead from what the diaspora are saying here in the United States. And what I'm hearing them say is they want to hold the Nigerian government accountable.
Is there something that, you know, putting on your hat as a longtime lobbyist, is there something in U.S. policy that you feel could be used to address this government to government?
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a couple of things that certainly come to mind for me. I mean, one of the things that we don't talk about here in the United States is this growing internal displacement problem in Nigeria. A part of the reason why we have conflict in countries like Nigeria is because people are not heard in the democratic process. That's something that our government can certainly be talking about. But then also there are issues of resources, and resources are so very important. In this same northeast region that we're talking about where these girls were kidnapped, we also have a situation of displacement, where people are not getting resources from the oil sharing. That's something that our government certainly can talk about and get involved with. But also the fact that people don't feel heard in the democratic process. So the fact that these girls, like some of your guests have already talked about, are literally being used as pawns, if you will, in the upcoming election. I mean, at least that's what it looks like from the reports we're getting. Certainly, we hope that our State Department is talking about that. We hope that the corporations, the vast corporations, American corporations that are doing business in Nigeria are also asking questions and see it as their role not to certainly attempt to take away sovereignty from the government, but to ask serious questions. There's certainly, you know, a lot of profit being made right now in Nigeria. We need to make sure that the people of Nigeria can live in safety and in prosperity as well.
Before we let you go, I wanted to take note that you recently concluded 8 years of service as the president of Trans Africa, which is kind of a very high profile organization in Washington, D.C. Can I ask about the timing? Why now? I mean, is it in part because as an activist, you want the freedom to offer critique from outside? I mean, originally, the kind of role of Trans Africa was to elevate the interests of Africa and the Caribbean within the halls of the U.S. government. Is partly what you're saying with your resignation that you feel that there are some times that you need to critique these governments and the way to do that is from the outside?
I mean, I think that there's a lot of different reasons. Certainly right now, there's a plethora of issues that have now kind of fallen into my lap, if you will, that I definitely want to talk about. But in terms of critique, I actually think it's more a critique of American leadership, if you will. Listen, you know, my personal opinion is, as a leader of a nonprofit, it's an amazing opportunity. You need to really, though, do your job in 7 to 10 years. This is not a dynasty. This is not Nicole Lee's dynasty. I really wanted to make sure that I contributed to Trans Africa, but at the same time didn't get founder syndrome, even though I'm not the founder. Didn't get that founder syndrome where I thought that I was the only person that could do the job. And that's really something that I wanted to hold myself accountable to more than anything else. I am so excited, though, because I see the changes in Trans Africa, the young people that are now involved, the diaspora folks that feel comfortable engaging in our organization. It's been an amazing ride.
Nicole Lee is a human rights activist. She is currently involved with the hashtag campaign Bring Back Our Girls. It's aimed at keeping focus on the kidnapping of those 200-plus schoolgirls in Nigeria. She recently concluded 8 years as president of TransAfrica, and she joined us in Washington, D.C. Nicole Lee, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We turn now to a story about hate, about crime, and about forgiveness. You might remember that in the days after the September 11th terrorist attacks, there was a spate of attacks on individuals who were perceived to be Muslim or Arab. One victim of those crimes was a former Bangladeshi Air Force officer who was living in Dallas, Texas. Race Bouillon was working at a gas station when a man named Mark Stroman walked in, asked him where he was from, and then shot him in the face. Bouillon was just one of the people Stroman attacked, all South Asian immigrants. Two of them died, but Bouillon survived. But although he suffered both physical and emotional trauma after the attacks, he eventually came to forgive Stroman, and not only that, to mount a vigorous campaign to spare him the death penalty. That remarkable story is detailed in the new book, The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. The author is New York Times columnist Anand Giridharadas, and he is with us now. Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us.
It is so good to be here once again.
First of all, tell us about, who do you want to start with? Mark Stroman. Tell us about him.
Well, let's start with Race. Race Bouillon grows up in Bangladesh, and he has this energy and vitality in him from a very young age that propel him from one success to the next, getting into a hard-to-get-into military boarding school, then getting into the Air Force Academy, then getting into the Air Force, then realizing, you know what, I kind of want to move to America because things are really happening over there in IT, getting a visa on his eighth try, finally getting to America, and realizing that, you know, New York's great, but he's got this friend in Dallas, calls him, says, come visit Dallas. He goes to Dallas, and he realizes, you know, the bathrooms in Dallas are as big as the bedrooms in New York. So he goes. And a few months after getting to Dallas, working in a convenience store of a gas station to try to kind of build his way towards this dream of working in IT, he gets shot in the face. And that's where Mark Stroman comes in. Mark Stroman is kind of an angry white guy, calls himself a true American patriot, in and out of prison and various things since he was a young man, but worked pretty stably in body shops his whole life, and becomes convinced in the days after 9/11 that his country has been attacked in a way that must be answered, that the Bush administration will be too timid to do anything about it, and that he, Mark Stroman, needs to take care of it himself. And does so by going to three gas stations in the Dallas area, walking in, seeing someone look what he called kind of Arab to him, and shooting the clerk in all three cases.
I remember those attacks. I mean, I certainly remember 9/11. And I also remember these attacks. And I remember each of them being, you know, a story, you know, a page, a couple paragraphs. I mean, maybe more if you lived in the area where these things took place. And then the trajectory that the story takes, Mark Stroman is tried, he is convicted of these attacks. Race has this whole other thing that happens after this. I mean, lots of things happen to him that I don't think anybody really knew about.
You're right that a lot of people paid attention at that moment of these crimes all over the country, some in Arizona, some in Texas, some elsewhere. The thing that was amazing to me is what made it a really American saga, as opposed to just a sad and bad story of hate crimes, was actually what happened to them afterward out of the limelight. And they both went on journeys over the next 10 years before this forgiveness thing happened. And Mark Stroman's journey was to get sentenced to death and to go to death row. And in the solitude of death row, with all of the bad influences from his life suddenly out of his life, all of the new people who come into his life, from religious ministers to documentary filmmaker to new friends, pen pals, all the new people are great influences. He becomes a better guy. And you see him melting. You see him becoming self-aware. You see him understanding what made him like this. Meanwhile, over those same 10 years, Race Bouillon has this spectacular American reinvention, you know, gets kicked out of the hospital the day after going in because I guess being shot in the face was a pre-existing condition before Obamacare, and is then casting around for medicine from free samples, but rebuilds as much as he can on the health front, rebuilds economically, finds some guy who finds another guy, works at the Olive Garden, as he put it, to help him overcome his fear of white people. The Olive Garden's a good place for that. And is able over the years to get six-figure work in IT in Dallas after this journey. And so both of them go on this road of 10 years. And then, 10 years in, kind of dramatically re-enter each other's lives.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with New York Times columnist Anand Giridharadas about his new book, The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. Race Bouillon came to public attention again when he decided to argue against the death penalty for Mark Stroman. We actually have some tape of this from NPR's All Things Considered, where he talked to one of my colleagues back in 2011, and here it is.
According to my faith in Islam, there is no hate, no killing. It doesn't allow anything like that. Yes, Mark Stroman did a horrible thing, and he brought a lot of pain and disaster, sufferings in my life. But in return, I never hated him. And by hating him, it's not going to bring any good solution to the society. But if he's forgiven, who knows?
Now, at this point, he'd never met Mark Stroman other than the time that he shot him in the face. And he was not connected to advocacy groups or anything like that. I mean, how do you explain this? Was this purely for his own spiritual growth? How do you explain it?
I think there were two things that happened. One that has to do with his faith, and the other that has to do with his status and observer of America as an immigrant. So the first thing with his faith is when he was dying, or thought he was dying, in the gas station, laying on the floor in his own blood, he, as many of us would, looked up to the sky. As it happened, he was a religious guy, but the secular would probably do the same in that moment, and said, God, if you save me, I'll give you everything. I'll serve others for the rest of my life if you save me. And God did save him. And yet he couldn't serve him for the next many years because he had to worry about his eye and his health and his $60,000 of debt and all of that. But at some point that passed and he got work again and he paid off his debt and he was whole and he was ready. And he went on the pilgrimage to Mecca, and there in Mecca very clearly had this sense that God was kind of calling in that old favor and saying, look, buddy, I saved you. You said you'd spend your life serving others. This is the time. And so had a strong sense that he had to do something for others. Now, so that's one of the two tracks. The second track was, all this time he'd been trying to figure out, what's going on in this society of mine? Was this just an isolated guy who was crazy? Or is there something going on in this society that allowed there to be a Mark Stroman? Hmm. And the longer he stayed in America, the more he worked at the Olive Garden, actually learned about his colleagues' lives at the Olive Garden, which appalled him. Many of their lives similar to Mark Stroman's childhood. Not very happy. The more he learned about the kind of ravages of drugs in the corner of America that he was in, he realized that what had happened was not a fluke, that there was a really hurting undernation in this country, and that Mark Stroman was the worst expression of a tendency that was wider than him. And the combination of those two streams forced him to come to this realization that I'm going to forgive this guy, but I want to do something bigger than forgiving him. I want to fight a campaign to save him, to show people that there's another way.
Hmm. You know, this is a very richly reported story. There is a tremendous detail, not just detail of things that happened, but detail around people's feelings and things that you would never think about. Like, for example, with Race Bouillon, the fact that he lost his fiancée because of this, because he didn't have any opportunity to, because he was ill and he couldn't go back to Bangladesh to follow through on the wedding. And so there was a real cost that was paid on either side. And also Mark Stroman was a father, and the fact that he had children. I don't want to give it all away, but I do want to ask you, what do you want the rest of us to learn from this journey that both of these men went on after being brought together in this really terrible way?
You know, I think as powerful as this story is, if it was just a story about two guys, I wouldn't have spent the last 3 years of my life on it. To me, it's a story about a man who was shot and got blind in one eye and yet was able to see something that most of the rest of us in America are in denial about, which is that there's an extraordinary number of us that have fallen so far out of the good life And it's not just a lack of jobs, but it includes a lack of jobs. It's not just the breakdown of the family, but it includes the breakdown of the family. It's not just schools that are failing or any number of other problems. It's all of these problems. Mm-hmm. And it's meth, and it's all kinds of things. And race, through his strange journey, was put face to face with this rotting part of the country, even as the other part of the country that still works and arguably works better than anywhere else in the world still served him very well. He was shot in the face, and he still got his American dream. He still was able to rise up, get education, learn, get help, make six figures, buy a house. So he has lived the America that I still believe, and I think he believes, and a lot of us believe, is not just okay, but really works better than any society's ever worked in human history still. But he was put face to face, as many of us from that America are not, with the rotting America that has stopped working some time ago and that we choose to drive past.
Anand Giridharadas is author, most recently, of The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. It comes out today, and he was kind enough to join us here in our studios in Washington, D.C. Anand, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, just over a decade ago, a rising star at the New York Times was finally caught for plagiarizing, even making up stories.
When this type of fraud took place at such a highly regarded institution, I think a lot of people just threw their hands up and said, ugh, everyone's corrupt.
A new film, A Fragile Trust, takes a new look at the Jason Blair scandal. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pajamagram Company, offering women's pajamas in gift packaging delivered overnight and for Mother's Day at pajamagram.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices, waltonk12.org. From LifeLock, reminding consumers that individuals with good credit are often targets of identity thieves. Learn more at lifelock.com, code NPR. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
This October, come aboard WILL's American History Train. We'll travel in private rail cars restored to their 1950s glory. Our private chef will serve delicious onboard meals as we travel to Boston, Washington, D.C., and Philadelphia for stops at historic sites, museums, and battlefields on this 10-day trip. For more information, call 217-333-7300 or visit will.illinois.edu/willtravel.
I'm Marco Werman. Some stories take time to tell.
Masked men armed with Kalashnikovs and anti-tank weapons now control every administration building.
There are many voices and they don't always agree.
They are talking about Russia's invasion. This is not true. There is no invasion, and this is the reality.
Join us and hear the world.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Fertilizer Dealer Supply, Philo, Cannon Farm, Camargo, Jarman Center, Tuscola, and the Andersons, Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Now we want to look back on a scandal that rocked one of this country's most prestigious news organizations. Jason Blair had been a rising star during a nearly four-year career at the New York Times. But in the spring of 2003, it became clear he had plagiarized or outright fabricated dozens of stories he'd allegedly written for the paper. He lifted passages from other people's work. He pretended to visit cities he never traveled to and wrote about information from confidential sources that did not exist. The scandal was painful and embarrassing for journalists, whether they worked for The Times or not, especially when it became clear that Jason Blair had gotten away with it for a very long time with very little effort, or so he later explained.
You know, none of it was rocket science. If you take a little from here, and if I steal a little from you here, and I steal a little from you here, and I steal a little from you here, no one really sees that a bunch of my stuff was stolen. They might say, ah, that paragraph's very similar, but the rest of it's different.
That's a clip of Jason Blair himself speaking in a new documentary that attempts to shed new light on all the factors that went into the scandal and what we can learn from it now. The film is called A Fragile Trust, Plagiarism, Power, and Jason Blair at the New York Times. It will air tonight as part of the PBS Independent Lens series. And director-producer Samantha Grant is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, for those who aren't familiar with your work, you are a very experienced filmmaker, and you describe yourself as a third-generation journalist. But I'm wondering what it is that you wanted to find out with this film, with your investigation of this issue that we didn't already know.
There had been a lot of coverage of the scandal at the time that it happened, but when I went back and looked at it as the potential subject for a film, I realized that there really had not been any kind of postmortem on what had happened. And it was time to put that together because there were some inconsistencies in the reporting that I wanted to correct.
So fast forward through a little bit of the story. Who was Jason Blair and how did he end up at the Times?
Jason Blair was a young reporter who worked at a number of newspapers as he was growing up, in high school and such. And then he got a number of prestigious internships at various papers, including the Boston Globe and the Washington Post. And he had great recommendations from some of his faculty where he went to school at University of Maryland. And he applied for an internship at the New York Times, got the internship, impressed some higher-ups, and eventually was hired.
So how did the whole thing unravel?
He was working there for a few years and was having some troubles with accuracy, is how it was described. At first, they were primarily just errors, and it wasn't until much later that the fabrication and plagiarism started. And that really was concentrated mostly in the last few months that he was there.
You do make a point in the film of noting some of the benchmarks in the rise of digital journalism, which is going along at the same time as Jason Blair was working at the Times and as this scandal was unfolding. What's the connection? Why do you think it's important to note that?
I do think that the rise of digital journalism and the transition from legacy to digital media was a factor in this story in a couple of ways. Number one is that Jason was able to take advantage of and manipulate some of the newer digital tools that perhaps some others weren't quite aware of. And number two, when the new editor was brought into the paper, he was brought in with the mandate to pick up the pace, to make things run more efficiently. And I think a lot of that mandate was coming down because of this culture of fear that had pervaded the media, specifically the newspaper industry, with the rise of digital.
You interview the reporter, Macarena Hernandez, from whom he plagiarized. Nobody knew that he didn't actually go to Texas. And that's the part that I just could never figure out. And you think the speed question is part of it? Is that things were just moving so fast, everybody wanted to pick up the pace that people didn't take the time to answer these questions? Like, did you really go?
That trip happened just a month or so before he was caught. So he probably wouldn't have had to turn in his receipts for that just yet. And when they asked him for receipts, when they were doing the investigation, that was really the moment at which he said, wow, I am going to have to fake these receipts if I'm going to get away with this. And it was really at that moment that he realized this was not going to work out well for him. With regard to the other stories that had happened prior to that, based on what I learned from speaking with people, it sounds like the communication systems between editors were not functioning really well, specifically because of what was happening in the wake of 9/11. And there was the fact that there was a brand new executive editor and managing editor at the paper who had come on board just 5 days prior to September 11th happening. So you have new leadership, and then you have the biggest and arguably the most terrifying story happening right in your own backyard at the New York Times right at the same time that this is all happening. So it was just sheer chaos, I think, in a lot of ways, which is not standard operating procedure.
So the scandal didn't just end Blair's career. It brought down managing editor Gerald Boyd and executive editor Howell Raines. And I think this is probably a good place to mention for people who don't know that Jason Blair was one of a handful of high-profile Black journalists at the paper. And Gerald Boyd was the first Black managing editor of the paper. And some observers blame the scandal on diversity efforts at the New York Times. I mean, you actually spoke with Howell Raines about that. And here's a clip from the film.
One of the frustrations I've had is that some people have suggested that I was lax with Jason because of white Southern guilt. I don't think there was a reluctance to blow the whistle on Jason based on race.
Just about everybody you spoke with denied that race was a factor in Blair getting away with what he did or how the whole thing kind of unfolded. So how did that become kind of a major part of the story?
The question of race became infused into the story simply by the way the mainstream media reported on it. All of a sudden, the story morphed into this story about race and affirmative action. And that was really incorrect. And one thing I just want to add here is that Gerald Boyd was not Jason Blair's mentor. And that was something that was avidly denied by both men. And yet somehow it was reported and it was re-reported. And I can only imagine that that must have been devastating for Gerald Boyd, especially since it wasn't true.
Okay, now we know what the what is. We know what happened. I described that at the beginning. But really what you want to get to is why. And I want to play a clip from a conversation that you had with Jason Blair. This actually appears very early in the film. And I'll just play that clip and then you can tell me more about that.
Why did you do it?
This one again. No. I don't have a good answer for the question. You know, I've gone over it, you know, many years, run it through my head. The basic conclusion that I come down to is that there isn't a simple one answer.
He's not the only person who's made up stories. I mean, famously, the Washington Post was forced to give back a Pulitzer Prize that was awarded to one of its reporters, a young woman named Janet Cook, who made up an entire figure, character, and wove a whole story around it. But well, what do you think it means? I mean, what is the broader lesson you think we should learn from this?
You know, the story of Jimmy's World and Janet Cook is also in some ways a simpler story to tell because it doesn't have these other elements.
Janet Cook was that Washington Post reporter who wrote that fabricated story I just mentioned. It was about a young boy named Jimmy who she said was addicted to heroin. And of course, he did not exist.
And I think anytime you are dealing with someone who does have mental health issues and drug abuse issues, it does get more complicated. At nearly every screening, somebody from the mental health field comes up to me afterwards and tells me that they think this is the perfect case study of somebody who has a bipolar disorder that's undiagnosed, and it causes their life to blow up because they haven't sought treatment.
Does Jason Blair think that?
He really does take responsibility on a certain level for saying it wasn't the mental illness that made him lie. But he does say it was the mental illness that made them so egregious.
After you spent this time on this project, and does it leave you with any thoughts about the field, about the way we treat people, about why we're drawn to this work ourselves? Did it leave you with any deep thoughts?
Certainly one of the things that I want to get across is that while the democratization of the media is a great thing because it allows more voices to participate, I don't think that individual voices will ever or should ever replace big media institutions, because we need those institutions to take on things like the government or other corporations.
And why do you feel like that's a part of this story?
What happened with Jason Blair really challenged the faith of a lot of readers. I mean, public faith in the media has been in decline for ages, but this story really was difficult for people to absorb because the New York Times was sort of the last holdout. Nothing like this had ever happened there. There was a feeling of invincibility. And when this type of fraud took place at such a highly regarded institution, I think a lot of people just threw their hands up and said, ugh, everyone's corrupt. And I think that's incredibly dangerous because if everyone just turns into their own corner and only reads news that supports their own personal agenda, then that's basically the end of dialogue in this country.
Filmmaker Samantha Grant joined us from San Francisco. Her new documentary, A Fragile Trust, Plagiarism, Power, and Jason Blair at the New York Times, debuts on many PBS stations tonight. You'll want to check your local listings for exact times. Samantha Grant, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Finally today, we've talked a lot about getting kids interested in STEM, that is to say science, technology, engineering, and math. We've talked about the lack of access to computer science classes and so forth. Right now, though, we are going to flip that script and we are going to meet a self-taught game developer from Miami, Florida, whose app, Four Snaps, is topping the charts on the App Store on iTunes. He's been so successful, he's been able to help his family financially when they've had some rough patches. And he was highlighted at Facebook's development conference last week by none other than Mark Zuckerberg. And oh, by the way, did I mention he's 17 years old? Michael Saman joins us now from member station WLRN in Miami. Michael, welcome. Congratulations on everything.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
How did you get started coding? I understand that you literally taught yourself from what? From YouTube tutorials?
Yeah, basically. That's how I got started. I actually, when I was around 12, 13 years old, I got interested in making apps. And basically what I wanted to do was just make them, right? I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to do something cool. So I just didn't really have any programming courses in my school or anything to go by. And I was like, well, the internet exists, so I might as well just go on Google, YouTube, and try to find out how to do it myself.
So what did you look up? Did you look up how to code? I mean, did you even know what that word was?
I kind of had an idea about how to program and stuff because I knew some things on making websites and things like that. But I started getting into making apps, and it's a whole different world. It's like a lot more complicated, and I didn't know it at first. So I didn't understand how big of a world it is. And I just started looking up little things like how to program certain things and little by little piecing it together. It's no way the most efficient form of learning how to program. It took me forever, but it worked.
It didn't take you forever. You're 17. Just I mentioned that. Anyway, so tell me about Four Snaps.
I started working on it junior year during final exams. I know, very bad timing. But I actually got started on the app because I saw my sister texting her friend some of the pictures on her phone, and her friend was trying to guess what the pictures were. So, like, they were playing a little game through text messages, and I was like, oh, wow, this would be a really cool idea for a game, right? Where people can take pictures and then have their friends guess what it is that they're taking a picture of, kind of like a word game. Mm-hmm. I had no idea how to start, but I basically said, well, I got to start doing something. So I started looking things up, getting things ready, and in no time I had an app ready.
At each stage, you had to kind of figure out what you didn't know and learn that thing. What was the big hurdle to getting it done?
I didn't exactly know what a server was or any of that type of thing. Like, I had no idea what a back-end service was. I didn't know anything about how to run games on the internet. So I had to figure out how to make a game where people would send it to each other. I don't have big farms filled with servers to be able to store data of people. So I think that was one of the tougher things, like having to deal with storage and making sure that images wouldn't take too much space on the servers and cost me money that I didn't have. So I basically tried to find a way to, like, grab the four pictures that people would take, combine them into one picture, upload them to the server, and then by the time they had to play the game, bring it back down from the server and split the picture back into four.
Did your folks know what you were doing? Because one of the things that struck me about this is that a lot of times when a kid's spending a lot of time in his room on the computer, parents get annoyed.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yes.
They're like, go outside or yeah. Do your homework or what are you doing? So how did you explain what you were spending all this time doing?
They didn't really understand what it was. Like, my app had reached number 7 in the top reference charts for the first time. And I had told my dad in the morning, like, waking him up, look, the app is number 7. And he was more like, oh, that's nice. You know, that's nice. Go do your homework. Like, I was like, well, okay. They didn't really think it would make such an impact until I got the first paycheck, of course. Once that happened, then constantly, hey, Michael, what rank is it? Or, hey, Michael, how's it going?
That was from your first app, right? How much did you make on your first app? Roughly.
On the first day, I made like $40. Second day, I made like $100. And the third day, like $200. It just kept going like that. So it was like incredible for me to experience that because initially I was just hoping to make like $100 to buy myself like a concert ticket or something. But it turned out to be a lot more.
It turned out to be a little better than that.
Yeah.
Well, I understand it that one of the things that you've been able to do is like help out with your tuition, for example, your tuition, yeah. Your sister's tuition, and some things like that.
Since my parents weren't lucky enough to, you know, have all these things here and everything, I told them, well, we're having bad economic situations, right? Well, it's the least thing I can do is help you guys, right? Like, they've been able to feed me every day, have a bed for me to sleep in, like, my entire life. So the least I can do is when they need the help, to help them out, right? So, like, I help pay the mortgage for the house and the rent for their small business and me and my sister's tuition, you know, anything I can do to help them.
Well, congratulations. And then I understand that you've got an internship coming up with Facebook, correct?
Yes.
And summer, right, and you graduate from high school in a couple of weeks. Congratulations on that. If it is fair to say, though, that your grades have kind of suffered a little bit in high school because you've been spending a lot of time, it's kind of like you have a really demanding after-school job.
Yeah.
Right? Have teachers been tolerant of that, or
well, actually,
are they kind of annoyed that you're not?
Yeah, they're kind of annoyed for the most part. But I'm worried about that because I kind of want a lot of teachers to know that technology is a big part of the world now, and coding especially. In my school, last year they had canceled the whole computer science department. It was incredible. I was extremely furious about it. And the whole importance on coding is not as strong as I would love it to be. You know, there's so much opportunity out there for kids to learn how to code. And if schools were to take a bigger part in that, it would be amazing. But I feel like there's a big part with, like, teachers also. Like, I feel like teachers don't want to be the ones to not know things, right? And I feel like since a lot of students know a lot about technology and, like, iPads and how they work, I feel like teachers kind of don't want to embrace the technology because of the fear that, you know, one day the student might outsmart the teacher. And I think teachers, you know, should try to learn, you know, the technology and try to just embrace, you know, the new stuff.
I've been speaking with 17-year-old developer, entrepreneur, Michael Saman. His app, Four Snaps, is one of the most popular on the iTunes App Store. And he was kind enough to join us from our member station, WLRN, in Miami. Thank you for joining us.
No, thank you so much. And I hope you enjoy Four Snaps with me.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.